Allison Claremont Lingo.
We're going to talk a little bit about her time at UW, Mossy and Goldberg.
Both.
Yeah, why not? So I can just pick up where we what we were talking about, and maybe Mossy's attitude towards women.
Women? Well, I think I'll start by saying I came here a wide-eyed, middle-class Jewish girl from Chicago, you know, grew up in David Mamet territory, a little younger than he, on the south side of Chicago, and then with white flight moved to Highland Park when I was 14. My mother went to the University of Chicago. She was valedictorian of her class and got a scholarship. And I'm not exactly sure why I didn't go, but it's interesting in terms of this interview because I went after my freshman year here, 66-67, I went to summer school and stayed at International House at the University of Chicago and decided that this is where I wanted to be. And I couldn't transfer right away, but the following winter, I went there for one quarter, didn't like the history department at all. Whereas here, I was really welcomed. I mean, sort of got Mossy and Goldberg's attitude towards women notwithstanding. You're in each of their lecture halls, one of 500 or more students. It didn't really matter. I was told, you know, that they don't like women and they were gay and whatever, but it didn't really faze me because what each of them had to offer was so much spoke to who I wanted to become at the time, being very open, having just spent a summer in Spain, my first time ever going to Europe with a group, but then going off on my own and meeting someone, a brother of a friend in Florence, opened my eyes to the wider world and to history to begin with. So I was very much, I think, primed to be open to Goldberg and Mossy. And I never forget walking, you know, in front of, you know, the union when I got here in the fall of 66 and seeing a dozen or more card tables, SDS, Trotskyites, you name it, everything was out there. And I just felt I hit nirvana. I mean, this was where I wanted to be. My mother was an old radical communist at U of C when she was a young girl. And so I felt this was where I should be. And listening to both Mossy and Goldberg, you know, blew my mind, basically. And as you see, I took voluminous notes of each of their, I barely let a word go by. I could write well at that time quickly. And I think being in the demonstrations, commerce was Dow Chemical. And hearing, as Mossy would have said, all the slogans and this and that, and then being confronted in that hallway, squeezed in like sardines, in the police right outside the door, I felt like, you know, the Jews were stuck in those cattle cars and died. I mean, it's not an exact parallel, but I'm not going to be stuck here when the police come in. And I was so right. They all got, you know, beaten up in their genitalia. And it was horrible. So I never stayed in the middle of a demonstration again because I didn't want to be a victim of that. And the more I listened to George Mossy, the more I realized that we were not, as our leaders were saying, in a revolutionary situation. That if we didn't, as he told us, and why I became a historian, was because if you do not understand your historical reality, you're doomed to be a victim of what's going on, that you have to understand the context. And he went into his child, you know, his experiences in Germany then before fleeing and all of that to help explain and explore why what was going on outside was much more complex and had deeper roots than any of us young people could ever understand. And so I realized that we weren't going to start a revolution based on that and my own understanding of history as I understood it. So that, I mean, that really was what was most important to me about George Mossy, was that he taught me to step back and look at the context and to think through what, you know, the subtext to what all the pundits and political leaders of the of our day, all these young people were doing. I mean, you can see it now more in, you know, IT with Mark Zuckerberg so young and running this, saying this is for the good, and then seeing what happens with Cambridge Analytica. There's a dark side. And I think Mossy, more than anything else, demonstrated to us and taught us about the dark side to history, and that you can't take it at face value. And so I went on to get my PhD at UC Berkeley and worked with Natalie Zeman Davis. Though there I was much more directly confronted by misogyny when I was going to be in the history of science. And I was again told that particular professor, I won't name his name, was not, really didn't think women should be in academia at all. I don't think Mossy or Goldberg went to that extreme. And this particular professor made life very difficult for me in the classroom, and I was going to quit. I mean, he wouldn't let his wife work outside the home. And then Natalie came, and I switched. And she talked to this professor later and told him I was a very good student. And he apologized for his behavior and gave me a job as a research assistant. Wow. Sort of make up for his, you know, assessment of me.
Yeah.
And so it's because of her and her example. And she certainly was a pioneer. And I was the TA for the first course taught in, she called it Society and the Sexes. She didn't want to leave men out. You know, this is about humanity. And so she was my, and still is my true mentor. She's going to be 90 this year, and we're going to celebrate.
She was on the Mossy Press Series Advisory Board.
Oh.
And then she just stepped down this last spring.
Yeah. Oh, did she? Yeah, but she's still pretty fiery.
Oh, yeah. So you arrived on campus in 66, 67.
Mm-hmm.
And which student organizations were you most drawn to?
Well, in the end, I mean, I was drawn to SDS, but again, I noticed there that you were only called upon if you were a woman if you had slept with the person speaking. So when I was at Chicago, I worked with Staunton Lynn, doing grassroots organizing there. And here, I ended up writing for the Daily Cal. I reviewed plays that on campus and things like that, and got involved more with poetry and drama, and took a lot of literature too. But history was my major. Worked with Maurice Meisner and Chinese history, and took a course on witchcraft. But I was mainly European intellectual history because of Mossy. I ended up being less involved, and partly because of Mossy, in the political fray, and because of my experiences. I lived on Mifflin Street, and I claim to be the one who started the Mifflin Street riot. And Ben Sidgwick, because, you know, we couldn't get a street permit, and our house, 512 Mifflin, was the was where the record player was, and I was in charge changing the records for whatever reason, right? And we were going crazy being on the sidewalk, and the police were at either end watching us, you know, with their, you know, all their equipment and their tear gas. And there was this one guy who always dressed, as I recall, either in a grass skirt or shorts, and had a crown of, you know, flowers on his head, and he pranced across the street, and we all looking like this and knowing the police were on either side. And I went into the house, and a policeman followed and knocked on the door, and he said, and he wanted to come in, and I said, you don't have a search warrant, you can't come in, this is my house. So he left, and I turned on Street Fighting Man from the Stones, and all hell broke loose. And that was when they threw tear gas. I couldn't sleep in the house, and I knew Eddie Elson. I don't know if you knew, he was infamous here. He was a lawyer. He called it loony law. He was someone on the left who wanted, like Reagan, to take people out of asylums because they were being oppressed there. He was pretty unstable himself and ended up committing suicide. Be that as it may, he started this no-hassle store with accoutrements for smoking hash and all of that, and bell-bottom jeans. I still have a pair, you know, original ones that a sailor wore. I should have brought them and worn them here, and that kind of thing. And I was friends with him. He was a colorful character. I met him at the Ratskeller. The older graduate students, when I met him, he was a graduate student in law, a law student. And as I'd walk in, he and his friends would kind of hoot at me and say, "Beautiful, innocent Allison, you know, what are you doing here?" Because I was this sort of wide-eyed, you know, little girl. And they helped, you know, teach me about what was really going on from their perspective. I mean, they weren't so old either, really. And that's where I ran that night, and I think I slept in his store or somewhere where he had a bed for me and had to stay away a few days. So that was, but all my friends, I mean, on Mifflin Street, that's where the weathermen developed. They wanted me to help them store guns. I said, no thanks. You know, I mean, they were ready. People went off to Cuba, friends of mine. I mean, there was both sides. There were all the drugs and the craziness and the sexual experimentation along with political radicalism. And leaving here from Berkeley seemed in a way tame in comparison to what was going on here, and listening to both the Mossie and Goldberg panels yesterday, today, make me realize why that this place really was, has deep roots in the left. And I knew it then, but, you know, and heard about it and read a little bit about it, but became much clearer with the panels that I heard yesterday and today.
I'm interested in how, in your experience, this Mifflin Street life intersected with the classroom. What's the traffic coming back and forth between ideas that are playing out,
right,
like, in the lead up to and through riots, and then
well, I went to a lot of meetings, I did, and all my friends were more active than I was. I was busy reading the books.
Yeah.
You know, I'm a slow reader, and to do as well as I did, you had to work hard. And my friends, who were just as smart as I was, laughed at me because I would bring home stacks of books from the library. You know, I still do.
Yeah.
And I think I closed it out to do my work. I wanted to focus on what felt most important to me at the time. And I felt somewhat guilty because I felt big things were going on campus in the world, but I didn't feel that I could contribute to that as much as I could to eventually becoming a historian. And you know, if I thought about it that clearly, I'm not sure. I was still very young and goal-oriented. And I felt everyone around me, or many of the people who lived on Mifflin Street, were very much taken up with their own either political or personal problems. And it included a lot of drug taking, which I didn't do. I was leery of it and saw the, you know, as Ginsberg said, the best of my generation lose their minds. So I was very careful and kept my distance. Though I did get involved. I right there was the co-op, the food co-op, and I worked there, as well as there was one, I think, over on Gorham, a big Whole Earth, where the, you know, there, ours was a little one and sold everything. And I loved being behind the cash register and talking to all the people and everything. And then there was one further away, on either Gorham or Dayton, where they had huge, you know, burlap bags of oats and all of that stuff. And that was, and I saw tomorrow or this morning, they were saying, on the beginning of this whole food revolution. And so I was attracted to that more than to being in the streets throwing stones at policemen with billy clubs. It just didn't seem useful to me, though I think it was in its own way. The protest did help stop the Vietnam War. Nixon said, had no effect, but I think it did. And so I did go to demonstrations, but I didn't want to be one of the leaders. I didn't feel I could. I didn't feel the guys wanted someone like me. But we would have amongst, you know, other friends of mine, serious. Oh, I know who it was with. It was with Mossy's TAs, whose names I can't remember now, who I would have intense conversations with. And they tried to dissuade me from applying to graduate school because there were no jobs, right? But by then I had the bug of history and I really wanted to go and I didn't really know what else to do with my life. You know, I wasn't getting married. You know, I just thought this was what I wanted to do.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about that decision. So you studied very broadly in the history department.
Here, yes.
While you were here.
Yeah.
Which Mossy courses did you ultimately take?
I'd have to look at a schedule, but I think you'd have to name them. I don't remember what that course was. I took whatever I could.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really have a clear picture, but.
And was the registration process?
I don't remember. I mean, I remember standing in line here and at Berkeley for everything, and that you had to push your way. But I don't remember feeling that I wouldn't get in. And I'm the type who, if I wouldn't get in, I'd go to the professor.
Yeah.
You know, there was no way I was not going to get into those courses, you know. And after I declared my major, you know, I would be selected as a junior anyway, you know. And I took philosophy, too. I took art history, comp lit. And I graduated early. So, because I did summer school and stuff. I mean, I was a student.
Yeah.
And so I enjoyed talking to the older students because they were more on the level I aspired to. And I would hang out. Especially with George Mossy's TAs.
Would that be in the Ratskeller?
Yeah, it would be in the Ratskeller. Sometimes they'd have parties at their house, but a lot at the Rat. A lot. Everything happened there. And I remember now, I see there's something about the first BN. I was at that BN on Picnic Point where, you know, we were like dressed in blankets and we went up there. I mean, I was kind of drawn in to this whirl, and I really didn't know, and that's one reason I'm here, was to learn the context of what was really going on. I've been too much in my own field in early modern French history to study my own past,
yeah.
You know. So it's interesting being here and learning about what was going on, you know, the subtext.
Did you think that the talk yesterday by Hacia Diner as an undergrad, her experience? Did that resonate with you? Lessons that she took away. She also went on to study.
Like, what did she, remind me of what lessons she had?
Killian, maybe you can help me here.
She
had three lessons.
Oh, right. I wrote them down. But
never take yourself and politics into the classroom.
Right. Oh, those. Right.
Keep the classroom and politics separate.
Right. I've done some teaching, you know, I raise my children and have gotten more active now, but I have kept my hand in, and I'd say I've taught at San Francisco State and at Mills, at Berkeley, North Carolina State, and I'd say on the whole I have kept to those rules. And I think comparing Mossy to Goldberg, I'd say I was more on the Mossy model, though he too, I remember, would talk about Germany and his experiences there. So it wasn't as if he kept his life a secret or why he was here in Madison. But you have to do it very carefully. I mean, I remember I taught the Reformation, and it was just when all the revelations were coming out in the 90s about the Catholic Church, all the pederasty, and I had some Catholic students there who were very young, you know, and they were appalled. But what was interesting was to be able to contextualize it back to the Reformation or before. And so it would be in that way that I would bring the present moment into the classroom. And now I'm writing a paper I'm going to give in Lyon. I was asked to give a paper on the first doctor who wrote a book of medical errors. This was called Popular Errors in 1578, and it became a literary scandal because he wrote in French, you know, not in Latin, about sex. And he dedicated it to Marguerite de Navarre and, you know, Queen Margot, and spoke directly to women saying, you should know this and that about your body. I mean, it was very sexy book for the time. I mean, even reading it now, I've written a paper, Popular Terms for Female Anatomy in the Age of Print, and it's a scabrous article just because I had to use so many terms, colloquial terms, for female anatomy.
Sure.
And then translate them, you know? And so he was trying to correct the misconceptions of the menu peuple, you know, the little people, and also teach them to better follow their doctor. Now, my book that just came out is a critical edition of the works of Louise Bourgeois, who was the first woman to write a medical text in the West. She was royal midwife to Marie de Medici and delivered the future Louis XIII in 1601 and all five of his siblings. And for that, she felt she brought, because she did it successfully, peace and prosperity to land. Without the birth of Louis XIII, of direct male heir to the throne, France could have been thrown into chaos again after the religious wars. And so she wrote this masterwork in which she incorporated her own autobiographical narratives about how she became a midwife, royal midwife to Marie de Medici, a vast networking scheme that she developed with ladies in waitings and servants and things like that that she describes. That's how I know all this. The first tradeswoman who wrote advice to her daughter that she incorporates into the book in the second volume, plus gynecological and obstetrical case histories and protocols for abnormal deliveries that was innovative for its time. Some of her protocols are still used to this day. And so I'm comparing her, because she was influenced by Joubert, who wrote the first book of Popular Errors, about, and she talks about the errors people make and the common misconceptions, she called them. And I'm writing this, and I'm a little wary of it, but I'm being encouraged by someone who's helping, you know, editing it a bit, to compare their methods for discerning truth from error and the problems doing that when you're talking about women's health, specifically sex, abortion, the point of conception, all of that today. You know, I allude to it in my opening remarks and say we are having trouble because of social media and other sources of so-called information with sorting out what's truth from falsehood now. But we aren't the first, nor will we be the last generation. And looking back to these two different authors who were ahead of their times in a lot of ways, but one, Joubert, was trying to keep hold of the medical hierarchy, which was very much a patriarchal one, based on Aristotelian principles that women were inferior to men, and humoral physiology, that they were the disorderly sex because of their cold and wet humors. Whereas Bourgeois says women could be equal to men if they could control their anger and therefore be equal in mind and body. So here, her approach to the medical hierarchy, specifically the one in which women interfaced with doctors, surgeons, midwives, was one where she hoped for a collaborative model rather than a hierarchical model. So that's what my paper is about. So that her truth also was involved with her embodied knowledge of her own experience. And at that time, I think it's different now, but men couldn't even look at women's private parts directly. They needed a midwife to be there to tell them what was going on. And women themselves had a certain modesty among themselves as well. And it came up in sharp focus at cases of contested pregnancy, rape, and virginity. And when a woman wanted to divorce, the only way she could in those days was to claim her husband was impotent. And in all of these cases, it would be because of social conventions around modesty that a midwife would determine whether the man was impotent. They were called trials by Congress. and there'd be a curtain, and the midwife would watch them engage in intercourse. You can imagine how no one could manage under those circumstances, right? And so Joubert and others, Bourgeois didn't speak to this particular issue, but many other doctors, surgeons, and jurists spoke against midwives being the ones who would be deposed, who would be in charge. And Joubert in particular said, their terms for female anatomy make no sense. They're flimsy and false, based on Aristotelian principles as well as Vesalian anatomy. So here you have this mixture of ancient approaches to knowledge and methods with the modern one. And you see it in both of them. And that's the other strain of my paper.
Awesome.
So I think it goes back in many ways to, I'd say, my two mentors, you know, indirectly George Mossy, indirectly Natalie Zeman Davis.
Yeah.
And so here I am.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So when did you arrive in Berkeley? Was it
1971. Mm-hmm.
And then when did you finish your PhD?
In 80.
Okay, and then you've stayed in
I've
the
stayed
area.
There, and I'm now a research associate in the history department, which is a faculty position, but not paid. Yeah, but I had to have recommendations from scholars, and they every year I have to, you know, show that I'm really working and not a dilettante. They don't want anyone on the roster who's not working hard to be a scholar. So that's what I do. And I hope to teach my book, you know. I wrote it with, it's over 1,000 footnotes and has a medical glossary of all the animal, vegetable, and mineral ingredients that Bourgeois recommended in her recipes. And she was for open source. She gave the full description, you know, recipe, whereas the men in her day, on the whole, except for those doctors who were progressive like she was, in Latin. They wanted their monopoly,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So it's very interesting to watch these the evolution of medicine and the way in which sex, reproduction, and women are interwoven into that power politics, as it was, sexual politics.
Yeah, it's really interesting.
I mean, one of the more progressive doctors wrote in the year 1612, treatise on hermaphrodites, and he dealt with, maybe you heard of that famous case of Marie or Marcisse, and who was probably hermaphrodite, and the church and state got involved, and it was this doctor who said, well, she is a he. When she was running, her genitalia descended, and they thought it was the heat, you know, in a humoral sense. And he examined her and decided, and what the court decided on the basis of his examination was that, and he ended up shacking up with a woman, that you guys can get married. The only requirement is you stay a man and she stays a woman. No changing your mind about it. You're okay if you just stay and be who you are. And that's what happened. This doctor saved that individual's life,
yeah.
Literally. And so these sexual politics go way back. I mean, Foucault wrote about this,
yeah.
Too.
Did you go into graduate school planning to study early modern medicine?
No, history of science. I was interested in history of science, and then I tried working with, you know, this professor, and it just, you know, it was oil and vinegar.
But this is still very history
it
of science
is.
Topic.
It is.
Yeah.
My first graduate paper was on midwifery in early modern Paris. Working with Natalie, I had to be a French historian, basically. That's what she did. So I went into her camp.
And who else was on your committee?
Jean Brucker, you know, Florentine scholar. Randy Starn, also Florentine, more in art history. And Bill Bousma. And outside was a medical anthropologist. So.
And what was, you said that Berkeley seemed tame.
Politically.
Yeah.
I think maybe by the time I got there, though, I mean, we had Patty Hearst, but there weren't many demonstrations to speak of. I mean, we got out of the war at that point. Nixon resigned. It was all Watergate then, you know. and the gas crisis, no one could get gas. So things shifted. And I think they were, here it's very condensed. There's with the student union here and everything, whereas Berkeley's much more spread out. And I think I also got as involved as I was in my work there. I was even here, I was even more so there as a graduate student. You know, I had to take the Latin workshop, and you know, I was busy every minute. So whatever was going on, I really tried to block out, you know, to get my work done. I mean, I'm sure there was a lot going on, but I was not into it.
And, did your parents stay in Chicago?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Do you want to go back to the topic of Mossy and Goldberg and their relationship to female students?
Well, I don't have much to say. I mean, I feel that they were, the word was, don't even try. And I didn't really. That one time, I remember I was in that Rexall drugstore where everyone went for breakfast, and that's when I went up to Goldberg and said, what do you think I should do? You know, should I quit and not be a covert assassin because the university has stock in Dow? And he said, no, you should stay. You know, but it didn't lead to a longer conversation or a relationship, you know, like, okay, let's sit down and have coffee, which from listening to his former students today was what happened. I think they both kept their distance from women, basically. And the politics of the time were such, I mean, this was before really women's lib or anything. I just swallowed it. I just accepted that and saw their brilliance and thought, didn't think much more about it. I mean, it's more in retrospect that, and I was interested in neither of these. I stayed till 11 at the Goldberg panel. No one brought up that issue either. And it's interesting to me that in this time that it wasn't. I think I'm going to go to the women's panel this afternoon and see what they say about the origin of the women's movement here, because that was just as I was leaving. I remember being on Bascom Hill and there was some big demonstration about women's rights and all of that, and I got caught up a little bit with that. That's the one area I think I did get active at Berkeley, and I joined several. I was in a scholars feminist group that was very intimate and interesting, and we talked about departmental politics then, and sexual politics. And then I joined just to try one that didn't include university people, and I didn't fit in at all. They were all intimidated by me. None of them had more than a college education, but I was just a first year grad. But somehow, I didn't feel comfortable with them, and they didn't feel comfortable with me. Yeah, so I left it after a while. It just wasn't a good fit. And then I worked at one of those phone networks where women called in if they'd been raped or whatever, you know, were pregnant. And but that was, at that time, lesbianism was a big hot button political topic, and a lot of women were becoming lesbian or thought they always were or whatever, and I got caught up in some of that, but I felt pressure to become a lesbian, but I wasn't. And being in this hotline group was run by two lesbians who then vied for my affection. And because of that, I couldn't handle it. I mean, again, it was like the personal became way too political. So I just went back to my books. You know, I escaped. I didn't want to get caught in the crosshairs of that. And I saw many women who did. I remember I went to the Berks every year, you know, and there was one year when it was all about sexual politics, and there were posters all over that there weren't enough workshops and panels on the history of homosexuality or lesbian or whatever the word that was used then, and that was the beginning of gender studies and the whole issue, between calling it gender or sex. And that was very interesting within the field and continues to this day, right?
Yeah.
And so that part I've gotten, but more as a scholar than as an activist. Though there was a period at Cal when it was very, especially in the English department that I was not a part of, we'd have all kinds of amazing, well, visiting scholars who would come and give performative lectures where they kind of, like Goldberg, but Goldberg and Wasserman were really themselves. These women, like, almost like stand-up comics, would dress counter to who they were physically. If they were very thin, they would overdress. If they were very fat, they'd show off everything. I mean, it was that kind of thing. And it was épater la bourgeoisie, you know. Let's shock academe. And so there was that period in the 80s when this was going on. It was fun. I mean, it was carnivalesque. It was really interesting to be there then, all contained within academe. Mm-hmm.
What she worked with Goldberg, and I was wondering if you ever ran into her.
Well, I know her work, but no.
Okay.
Well, so didn't many women work with him? Do you know?
I don't think so.
Mm-hmm.
No, but she's obviously.
Right. Well, she could. I think he would have. You know, maybe. Obviously, he did. I just don't know. Well, she's brilliant, you know. I don't think they would have turned away brilliance, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Whatever. I think they just felt uncomfortable around women as some gay men of their generation did. I don't think that's so true now at all. You know, my daughter's best friend my daughter went to the University of Chicago. Is this Alex, this gay guy, and he's part of the family. But I don't think that was so true in that generation. It was more separate. And maybe they were afraid of being exposed. I don't know. I mean, people are closer to them. You probably have heard more of that kind of discussion than I have, having never really come back here for any length of time.
Is this your first time
back? It's my third. I went once. I came here just to see friends in the early 80s, and then I came for the 20th reunion, and it was a picnic, and it wasn't on campus, so this was the first time. When I got here Thursday night and walked around and walked into the Ratzkeller, tears came to my eyes because it looked just the same. And then I walked around and saw, you know, Bascom Hall, and I mean, the things that looked the same, I mean, it just was deja vu. It was overwhelming to be here again because it was so much the same. You know, enough has been kept the same. And I mean, there's a lot of change, of course, but in Paul's bookstore, that was it. But that's still here? Wow. So it's been very moving to come back this time and very special. And then going to the Mossy reception yesterday, not really bumping into Suzanne Desane, who was a graduate student when I was there, and just being amongst other Mossy, you know, people who appreciate George Mossy was wonderful. I mean, I just felt at home, you know. I feel very much at home here amongst historians.
Sure. Yeah.
We're a special breed.
Yeah, absolutely.
Not too many of us around.
No. We've tried to ourselves.
Right. I just, whenever I go to conference, I'm home. You know, these are people, I may not agree with them, but we're more or less taught in the same way to think, and it makes all the difference.
Yeah.
Just feel comfortable.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I guess I would just ask if you have any other memories of Madison in the 60s that you'd want to share, beside and beyond the Mifflin and the Goldberg.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Impressions of individuals that you
Well, I remember I don't know which election, maybe it was it Nixon and Johnson? I know, who would it have been? But I remember going outside of the university bubble and knocking on doors and being around, you know, people from a different educational and socioeconomic background than all of us students. And it was really eye-opening again, you know, to not to be looked at with skeptical eyes and questioned and challenged about my beliefs. And I realized again, you know, and that's part of, I think, going to university, such as this, you know, public university, that you discover, and getting out, you know, forcing yourself outside that bubble and seeing what's around you. And I was really shocked by their lack of encouragement or hospitality, you know, or anything. And what else? I mean, I think I learned how, I mean, as anyone else, it was a rite of passage, a transition. I think what was happening in the 60s was, you know, the breakaway from 50s and traditional values. And one of the first places where I experienced it was in the dorms, where when I came here in 1966, and I lived at Carroll Hall, which was a new dorm, hated it. I had two roommates in the same thing. I couldn't work, you know. So I had to switch to a dorm. I was trying to remember the name of it. And Carroll Hall was mainly Jewish girls from the suburbs. And I, even though I didn't like living in the suburbs, I'm more of an urban person, so I couldn't stand it at all, the chit-chat. And so I moved to a dorm that was WASP, where you had to dress for dinner and couldn't be late. But I had a single room, so I could work, right? And then I couldn't wait to break free. And you could then, just as a sophomore, live in a house, a real house, with kitchen privileges, it was called. Your parents had to sign that you could be outside the dorm, because there you had a curfew. And men weren't allowed, right? And this was the period of sexual liberation. Everyone was sleeping with everybody. And that's when eventually, my junior year, I moved to Mifflin Street. So it was this huge switch from being very protected, with the university being in loco parentis, to being, at age 20 then, 18, completely on my own. And it was, you know, again, this jaw-dropping experience to be able to experience, you know, interface with life without someone looking over my shoulder and saying, when are you going to be home? And you have to be home, and you sign in and out. And so I think I experienced that transition in our culture, too, from that to that, which most college kids now, it's a free-for-all in the dorms. I don't think I would like that, particularly for my own reasons, but be that as may, that's the culture now. So I think I was part of that transitional generation who moved, you know, being born in 48, where I really was formed in the 50s, more or less, but then was confronted with all these new norms of freedom that we all had, including drugs, sex, and everything. And I think, for me, what kept me together was work, you know? And history. And Freud said, you know, you need to be able to work and love. You need both. And so that's the balance, I think, you know, love in the largest sense. And I think, for me, history became my core. I taught it to my children. They'll say, okay, I know, Mother. You know, would they be going through? I say, well, you have to look at the historical underpinning. All of the things that Mossy taught us about, I think, carry through to this day for my life. And so I think this was where I cut my teeth. And so... oh, and I also worked at the Historical Society. Yes, I worked in the archive there. and I worked on Edna Ferber's papers, of all things. They just randomly gave them to me. And I thought about becoming an archivist, you know, and then going to France and working in the archives there, 16th century, notarial records and court records, found, you know, cases of charlatans and things like that. It was here where I, the roots of my historical identity were created by working there. I mean, I gravitated to that. And I loved working. I loved long hours, and I loved when I was in the archives in France, you know, deciphering the paleography. And I'd sit there for hours just like I sat over Edna Ferber's paper. So I think I was just meant for this kind of thing. So the other parts, you know, here there was the music, the big be-ins and the concerts. And I don't like loud music. Like I last night I went to hear the Temptations, which I wouldn't normally do, but I thought I want to experience the whole thing. It wasn't, and I told my friends who I went with, if it's too loud, I'll have to leave. Because I think I have good hearing where so many people of my generation don't. I think 'cause they went to those loud concerts. And because of that experience in Commerce Building and being stuck in there, I never liked crowds. You know? So again, so much, just in talking to you now, I see the patterns of what happened to me in the first 2 years here has shaped my life, basically. You know, socially, intellectually, sexually. I mean, everything started here. And, you know, there was this smorgasbord of tables of what, you know, club you wanted to join. And I ended up doing, you know, working for the Daily Cal, again, writing about being part of the Fourth Estate, you know, which they say is the beginning. You know, they write the first draft of history, right? So I think that says it all. Sure. No, I think that's good.
This was great. I'm really glad you were able to come by. Thank you.
I hope it was helpful and informative.
Very much.